You know who the real heroes are? The guys who wake up every morning and go into their normal jobs and get a distress call from the commissioner and take off their glasses and change into capes and fly around fighting crime. Those are the real heroes.
You got a suit? And suit up.
Good morning, Hope. He is risen.
He is risen indeed.
He is risen.
He is risen indeed.
I can never get enough of that. My name is Danny. I'm a pastor here. I'm so glad to be worshiping with you today. And I want to start off by asking you this question. What are you looking for in a hero? Or who are you looking to be the hero in your life? It's an important question that we... Is anybody mishearing this?
Spider-Man does whatever a spider can.
What?
Spins a web anytime.
Oh, man. Oh.
Catches things.
Oh.
Just like guys, look out.
Can somebody turn this off? Anybody? Oh, my. Can I help you? Can I help you?
Preacher Boy, I heard you're looking for a hero to save, and luckily that's just my specialty. Who here wants to get saved?
Okay.
Nope.
Hey, we appreciate the offer. That's super kind of you, and I hope I don't offend you, but... We're talking about a different kind of hero today. We're talking about how we need Jesus, not necessarily Spider-Man.
Wait, you think I'm Spider-Man?
Yeah.
Oh, I know. It's the mask, isn't it?
The mask, the suit, the theme song, pretty much everything screams Spider-Man.
I'm not Spider-Man.
Who are you?
I'm Daddy Longlegs.
Oh, Daddy Longlegs.
Moron. Yeah, Daddy Longlegs.
What do you do? Do you spin webs?
No.
Do you fly acrobatically in the air?
No, even better. With these God-given long legs, I'm a world-class speed walker.
Whoa.
At top speeds, I'm almost as fast as the average jogger. But I'm sure you're like, wow, I wish I could be like him. It's not all glorious at the top, preacher boy. Sometimes it's really hard being me. With great power comes great responsibility.
So, have you ever just tried running?
Are you trying to get me disqualified from the World Race Walking Tour? Running is strictly prohibited.
Okay, well, how do you catch the bad guys then?
Didn't you ever take a science class?
A couple.
Yeah, must have skipped them. Daddy long legs have super stink glands.
Oh.
Yeah, my odor is so pungent, it makes my enemies weep.
Oh, wow.
Do you want to see?
No, I do not. That's all right, actually. Seriously, truly. It's okay. Thank you, but no thank you. We're so glad that you're here, but you're fine. Really, you're fine.
All right, fine. Well, suit yourself. I gotta run anyway. I mean, walk. I have to walk. But don't hesitate to reach out there, preacher. You know, I'm just your friendly neighborhood Daddy Longlegs at your services.
Again, it's
for
like you
Easter.
Just
yep.
Take
1,000 miles.
Every line from Spider-Man. Let's give him a round of applause, huh?
Da da da. Da da da.
Oh, wow. You can't get better than that. We love heroes, don't we? But it's interesting that the world's heroes, or the heroes that we come up with in our own brains, of course they have some sorts of limit. They have some sort of limit. every single hero that we've ever created has a weakness. Superman has its kryptonite. Now, I'm not trying to tell you that I'm anti-hero. I like the Taylor Swift song, but I'm not anti-hero. In fact, I was always pro-hero. I love heroes. This is me and my siblings when we were kids. You can say, aw, it's fine. But anyway, this is me and my siblings when we were kids. We loved superheroes growing up. We'd dress up as Batman and Robin and Batgirl and Wonder Woman and Superman. We thought that we were real superheroes, so much that we'd go up to the top of the stairs, climb over the railing, jump off onto the couch below. I don't know where my parents were either, but we really believed, right? Like, we were so all about heroes, and the truth is ever since about the 1930s, every generation has been fascinated with the idea of a superhero, so much that Marvel can put out the same storyline, like 27 different times when we go to the movie theater every single time. I'm one of them. I can't help myself. We love this idea of superheroes, and why is that? Here's somebody who I think would have a pretty good idea of why. This is Jerry Siegel, who's the creator of Superman. Jerry Siegel was asked, why did you create Superman? And he said, what led me to creating Superman in the early 30s? Now, keep in mind, Jerry Siegel, he was a Jewish man, and he remembered and was able to observe what was happening in Germany during the 1930s, in Nazi Germany, where there was incredible and devastating oppression. So he said, I had this great urge to help the downtrodden masses somehow. How could I help them when I could barely help myself? Superman was the answer. I think that we can relate to that in a sense, maybe not to the experience that he had it, but we know what it's like to feel helpless and to feel like you'd like to make a difference in the world, but you can't even help yourself. And so when Jerry Siegel saw that there was a need in the world, he felt like the answer was Superman. And Superman, as we lovingly know him as Clark Kent, his original name was Kal-El, which Jerry Siegel got from two Hebrew words, Kal meaning voice and El meaning God. So Superman's original name, according to his creator, is voice of God. When he saw that the world needed an answer for the pain and the devastation and the helplessness, he pointed to the voice of God, God's intention. And Superman, for him, was God's intention in the world. Someone who is unwavering in his faithfulness and loyalty, but also unmatched in his strength and ability. This was an answer, the voice of God. And this is something that we all feel like we need. What else will do when we're looking for a hero other than someone who would be unbending in their faithfulness and loyalty, unmatched in their strength and power? But today, I'm not telling you about Superman to point you to Superman, the comic star, but rather, I want to point you to the voice of God, someone who's actually named the voice of God, literally. It says this in John chapter 1. Our Bible reading for today comes from the book of John. This is at the very beginning. It says, in the beginning, the Word already existed. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. So the Word became human and made his home among us. You know who this is? This is Jesus. This is God in the flesh. He's called the Word of God, the voice of God, God's true intention for this world. Someone, himself, who is unbending in faithfulness and loyalty, and also unmatched in power and ability that even the greatest darkness and evil of this world is no match for him. This is the hero that we need. And John is making a huge claim here. John is making a claim that there is a real world who came to, a real hero who came to the real world. Like, step out of the comic books for a second. It actually happened, John is saying, and so did the other biblical authors. There is a real hero who does not have a weakness, but is unbending in loyalty and faithfulness, is unmatched in power and strength, and he came into the real world. It's important for us to know that, because it's easy for us to think that, well, of course, back in those days, the ancient people, they were so credulous, right? They were superstitious. They believed in myths and legends and all sorts of tales that we would never believe or fall for today. But if you read the gospel accounts, that can't be true. These people were no more credulous than us. They were no more superstitious. They were suspicious. They were plenty skeptical about what they were seeing on the first Easter Sunday. You don't have to look any further than our Bible reading for today. This is in John chapter 20. Do you remember what happens? Early on Sunday morning, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and found that the stone had been rolled away. They have taken the Lord's body out of the tomb, and we don't know where they put him, she said to some of Jesus' disciples. Are you catching that? Mary was a close follower of Jesus. She was one of his closest friends. She listened to his teaching. She saw his miracles. She saw how faithful he was. All of Jesus' disciples, everything that they've heard him say up to this point has come true. There is no doubt about his word, about his intention. This is who he is. What he says happens. And up to this point, Jesus has been reminding them over and again, I'm going to die, but on the third day, I'll rise again. And yet, here comes Sunday morning. It's the third day. And nobody's there to even see if it was actually going to happen. You've got Mary who shows up, and she sees an empty tomb, and she doesn't put it together to say, oh, okay, well, Jesus was right. Instead, she says, somebody stole him. What's wrong? What's happened? I point this out to name this. Even Jesus' closest followers, when they showed up to an empty tomb, they were full of doubt. They were no more credulous than us. They were just as skeptical. And it's interesting, none of Jesus' followers were even there to check, was he telling the truth? I mean, if there was even a little bit of a chance, wouldn't you want to know? Makes me think of the deeply theological character from the profound movie Dumb and Dumber, Lloyd Christmas, who says, so you're telling me there's a chance? Okay, I read you, right, okay. I mean, if there's even a little bit of a chance, you get your hopes up. Makes me think of how every single year I fill out that dang bracket. And I don't just fill out one, I fill out 12. Why? I don't know. Because even though it's pretty much impossible, there is this tiny little statistical possibility that I might be the one who fills out a perfect bracket. Someone's got to do it right. Why not me? And so I fill out more and more and more. And every single year in my family bracket, I find myself doing things I promise I wouldn't do again, like trash-talking my one-year-old nephew, right? Like, what's wrong with me? There's this tiny little chance. I mean, and the price to pay is free, so why not? I mean, come on, the possibility of the reward in return, and I don't know what the reward in return is for winning the family bracket. I've never done it, right? I don't know what the reward is for getting a perfect bracket. I've never gotten it, but oh, there's that little chance, and it doesn't cost anything. Why not give it a shot? So it was for the disciples. Like, they weren't even giving it a shot. Jesus had said, I'm going to rise on the third day. They were just as skeptical as us. Just as full of doubt. Sometimes as Christians, we think, or maybe people who aren't Christians, you might think that in order to be a person of faith, you have to throw thinking out the door. You need to throw reason out the window. You have to turn off your brain and just tell yourself that you believe this stuff. But that's not how Jesus' followers came to faith. Take a look at Simon Peter when he shows up to the tomb. Simon Peter's one of the people that Mary ran to. So you got to come look at this. I think somebody stole Jesus' body. Simon Peter arrived and he went inside. He also noticed the linen wrappings lying there, while the cloth that had covered Jesus' head was folded up and lying apart from the other wrappings. This is really interesting. It says that Simon Peter noticed, and when it uses the word notice there, it is this really significant biblical Greek word, and it's theareo. Would you try saying that? Theareo. It's where we get our word theory from. He's furiously reasoning. Furiously thinking, trying to rationalize what's happening. And you can see it just in that little passage there. He's looking around the tomb. He's looking at the evidence. He's considering what might have caused this tomb to be empty. And he's not immediately buying into it. He's full of doubt too, isn't he? But he's looking around. He sees that there are some cloths. He sees that Jesus' headcloth was folded up. That doesn't make a lot of sense. A lot of times we think that faith means you just have to turn your brain off, but that's not the truth. I'm excited that I get to tell you that faith is more than reasoning and thinking. It's more satisfying than that. It really is. But it's also not less. And to be a Christian, to have faith is not to turn your brain off. In fact, I would say in order to make it through some of the most difficult experiences of our lives, you really got to think about it. You really got to reason through it. You really got to rationalize, is this what I really believe? Am I really in with this? Because if there's no substance to it, we could fall off pretty quickly. Faith is more than reasoning and thinking, but it's not less. And when the disciples are looking at the tomb for the very first time on the very first Easter Sunday, they do not turn their brains off. They're looking at the evidence. And somehow they came to the conclusion that this empty tomb didn't have to leave them with doubt, but could change their lives because of what they saw. So what did they see? What was the evidence that was there? And does it mean anything for us today? I can't possibly go into all of it, and that's not even necessarily my goal. But I do want to show you that there's intellectual credibility to this. Even for people back then and people today, who are suspicious of this stuff, skeptical of this stuff. And maybe you're saying to yourself, well, just through and through, I'm a skeptical person. Well, through and through, if you're a skeptical person, let's be skeptical of our skepticism. Sometimes I find that the only thing I don't doubt in the world is my own doubts, which means that I'm really not that skeptical. I'm just trusting myself when maybe I should look and think and reason. So here are four historical facts that I just want to look at and consider with you. Is the evidence legitimate? Because faith is more than reasoning and thinking, but it's not less. The first is this. Here's a historical fact. Jesus was a real person. And there is no serious historian who denies that. We have extra-biblical sources that tell us that Jesus was a real person. Josephus, who is an ancient Jewish historian, wrote, "There was about this time Jesus, a doer of wonderful works." There was a real man named Jesus. He had a real face, real nose, real eyes, real mouth, everything. He was actually there. And maybe you don't believe that he's the Son of God. Maybe you don't believe that he's divine or rose from the dead. But what we can't deny for sure, a historical fact, is that there really was a person named Jesus who lived about 1,000 years ago. And even someone who didn't follow him, Josephus, acknowledged he did all sorts of wonderful works. Historical fact number one that nobody can really debate is Jesus was a real person. Let's think. Let's reason. Historical fact number two is Jesus did claim divinity. Make no mistake about it, Jesus claimed that he was God, and even his opponents knew that he was claiming this. Jesus was in a debate with some religious officials that did not like him very much, and they're picking up stones and they're ready to kill him. He says, "Why are you doing this? Is it any of the work that I've done?" They said, "We're stoning you not for any good work, but for blasphemy. You, a mere man, claim to be God." Jesus undoubtedly claimed to be God. It is a historical fact that Jesus was a real person who really and actually did claim to be God. Historical fact number three that I think is important to consider is this. Jesus died on the cross. Sometimes people will say, well, if somebody saw Jesus after the supposed resurrection, it means that he didn't really die. Maybe he was just passed out. Maybe he was asleep. Well, first off, reasonably, rationally, that doesn't make a lot of sense. His body was beat down to a point where he didn't look human anymore. If he didn't die on the cross, surely he would have died in the tomb by himself. But even so, we can see from the clues in the scriptures that Jesus really did die on the cross. It tells us that one of the soldiers pierced Jesus' side with a spear as he's on the cross, and immediately blood and water flowed out. This was something that they would do back in those days to ensure that someone was dead. You'd pierce them in the side, and it appeared that water and blood came out separately. Now, they didn't have the medical knowledge that we have these days with that. They didn't understand how blood formed. Blood forms because there's a serum and there's red blood cells. And when you die, the blood clots. And so the serum, which looks like water, and the red blood cells, they separate. And so if you were to be stabbed, it would appear that water comes out and red blood cells come out. It's interesting. This looks like it's a throwaway verse in the scripture. And yet somehow God's using that because it wasn't until about 150 years ago that medical science was able to understand that that actually happens when you die. What seems like a throwaway verse in the scriptures is actually something where it's like, I think God might understand what's happening here. I think he actually might work through his word. Jesus really did die on the cross and nobody doubted it. In fact, the Roman soldiers who were there watching over this execution, they knew that if any person came off of the cross alive, that Roman soldier would be the next person hanging on a cross. It was that serious to the Roman Empire. They took crucifixion very seriously. It is a historical fact that Jesus died on the cross. And there is no serious historian who denies that. This fourth fact might actually surprise you. Jesus' tomb was empty. It is a historical fact that the disciples saw an empty tomb. And that might surprise you. You might think, wait, how is that possible? Well, again, let's think about this rationally. Let's think about this reasonably. Jesus' followers, we know, went around and told people, he's risen from the dead. In fact, it must have gotten really annoying. When they were walking around the streets, they did what we did today. They'd say, he is risen. And someone would say back, he is risen indeed. I wonder if it was like 20 years ago and people were walking around me, I'm like, what's up? It's just drove you nuts, you know? And the religious establishment, they had everything to lose. All they had to do was to show a body. The Roman Empire, who did not want to lose control over anything, all they had to do to shut up these Jesus followers would be to show the body. but they couldn't. Meanwhile, they made sure that this tomb was guarded. See, it wasn't just Jesus' followers who heard Jesus say, I'm going to rise again on the third day. His opponents, his enemies, they knew it too. Jesus must have been saying this so much that it tells us that Pilate replied, take guards and secure his tomb the best you can. So they sealed the tomb and posted guards to protect it. History tells us, and context tells us, that there would have been 16 to 30 trained Roman guards who were essentially trained assassins, trained killers, guarding this tomb. And again, if anybody got to the tomb, they would be killed. So who got there? Did the disciples steal the body? Did Mary steal the body? How did they get past the Roman guards? And if they got past the Roman guards, how did they move the 2,000-pound stone? And if they were stealing the body, did they really take time and say, hey, Peter, you got to make the bed. You got to make sure his head cloth is folded. Maybe some people have said, I don't know, dogs came in. They stole the body. I don't know, my dog Denver can't fold sheets. There's no way. Like, we're running out of options here. Now, I know it's convenient that I'm using the New Testament for all sorts of sources here, and maybe you feel like that is unfair. Because a lot of times people will say, well, the New Testament, the Bible, it's a very biased source. And so therefore, the Bible's been changed throughout the years, and once upon a time, it didn't say all sorts of things like this. I mean, it has changed. Clearly, it's changed over the years. There's no doubt about that, right? I mean, it started off as just these people who loved their leader, but eventually it turned into this myth and this legend, and we don't know how it got out of control, but it just did. How do we know that the New Testament is a credible source? Well, we know it through a study called textual criticism. Textual criticism is this study that tells you if an ancient document is credible or not, if that has been changed over the years, or if what it is describing actual historical events. So the way that they do it is they count up how many manuscripts they have detailing a certain historical event. So if you have a lot of them, they all say the same thing, it means that things weren't changing. Now, also, what they would consider is how early were those manuscripts written? And the closer that those manuscripts were written to that historical event, again, the more credible it would be. But with ancient history, oftentimes we don't have very many documents, and oftentimes it wasn't written down until many, many years after the event took place. This is just how ancient history was recorded. But historians don't have an issue with this. Here's Caesar's Gallic War, for example. Caesar's Gallic War, you probably learned about this in school, or you're eventually going to learn about it in school, and nobody doubts what you learn about when we read about Caesar's Gallic War according to the manuscripts that we have for this. We have 9 to 10 manuscripts that tell us everything about that. 9 to 10 of them. And they were written 950 years following the events. I'm not saying Caesar's Gallic War didn't happen. I'm saying it did happen. And every serious historian out there agrees, it happens. This is the way that ancient history was recorded. Now, every single ancient document is about like that. You might have as few as 2 documents, and in some cases, you might even have as many as like 100 or 150. But what about the New Testament? Take a look at this. The New Testament, we have 5,309 Greek manuscripts, 10,000 Latin manuscripts, 9,300 other manuscripts, all written within 130 years following the events of Jesus' resurrection. Not a single one of them says that he didn't rise from the dead. They all say the same thing. Jesus did, in fact, rise from the dead. And how can this be? I know that sometimes it's popular, people get carried away and they say things like, well, the gospel accounts, these stories about Jesus, they were written hundreds of years after Jesus lived, and that's simply not true. The Apostle Paul, who wrote much of the New Testament, he's writing and working with people who were eyewitness accounts of the resurrection of Jesus Christ within 20 years of it happening. John, the author of our gospel account for today, he's writing this within 40 years of it happening. It's surprising when we look at the study of this. I wish that there was some way that I could show you that the New Testament stands alone. I wish I had some sort of illustration that really pointed this out, where it's like, okay, clearly, we just have this whopper of evidence that's really out there.
Bring it in. Come on. Bring it in, boys. Here we go. I got a delivery for you here, skinny pants.
Skinny? They're not that skinny today.
Here. Sign here, please.
All right. It's a delivery. Wait a second. Aren't you Daddy Longlegs?
Hey, buddy. Don't blow my cover. Yeah, did you sign it? Yeah, just pop it right there. That'll be good.
How do you have time to do this when you got the whole superhero thing? Whoa!
That'll do.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know if you know this, there, preacher man. But the old superhero thing's my, that's pro bono. This is my 9-to-5.
Oh, understood. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Do you work for FedEx, UPS?
Actually, we merged. We are fed up.
Understandably, we should probably be a lot nicer to delivery drivers.
I agree.
So what do we got here?
Well, it looks like you ordered about 25,000 manuscripts detailing that Jesus did, in fact, rise from the dead.
Ah, wow. Thanks. I appreciate you dropping it off.
Wait. I got to take a picture for corporate. I got to make sure everyone's safe and good. The delivery came okay. So we just like hop in there? Yeah, that'd be good. All right, thanks.
Yeah, send it to me.
Pleasure doing business with you. I'm just your friendly neighborhood daddy. Nope, just kidding. I'm a delivery man. It's still between 9-to-5. I got to run. Actually, nope, I have to walk. But good seeing you, sir.
Delivery man, everybody.
Yeah,
look at him.
Go.
All right, what a hero, if there ever was one. So it's not 25,000 documents, but it's 25,000 sheets of paper. And just so you know, we still have these in the wrapping because we're going to be using them in our office. They're not going to waste. I promise you that. But we got 25,000 sheets of paper here. If you had all that, we would have this telling us about Caesar's Gallic War. And again, it happened. It's a historical fact. About 9 manuscripts. And no serious historian doubts it. And meanwhile, we have 25,000 manuscripts of the New Testament. One of the pioneers of textual criticism, his name was F.J.A. Hort, and he wrote it this way. He said, "In the variety and fullness of the evidence on which it rests, the text of the New Testament stands absolutely and unapproachably alone amongst ancient prose writings." And it's not just him, it's also other brilliant minds throughout history. Here's Dr. Simon Greenleaf. Dr. Simon Greenleaf was the professor who resurrected Harvard Law. Harvard Law, within its first couple of decades of existence, it was starting to die out. He was the only professor left on staff, and one of the ways that he thought that he could put a fire into the students once again is he gave them a project, and the project was to disprove the resurrection of Jesus Christ based on the way that they would treat it in a legal court. Dr. Greenleaf expected that they would be able to do it, and yet Dr. Simon Greenleaf, the guy who resurrected Harvard Law, said the resurrection is one of the best supported events in history according to the laws of legal evidence administered in courts of justice. I mean, at a certain point, why was the tomb empty? Is it possible that Jesus didn't rise from the dead? Just with some sort of argument out there. You could probably come up with one, I don't know. But is it plausible? You tell me. I mean, at a certain point, when you turn on the thinking, when you turn on the reasoning, when you really try to rationalize this, in some ways, we might dare to say that it takes more faith not to believe this than to believe this. And I've just gone off of a very small pool of facts to tell you today. But while I say that, I'll also say this. That might be intellectually satisfying for your curiosity. But in my experience with doubt, I have learned that most doubts are more than intellectual. They are personal. In my experiences with doubt, I'm a pastor. I grew up in a pastor's family. My dad is a pastor. His brothers are pastors. I'm praying our daughter Lainey will be a pastor. But anyway, no, it's her choice someday. She's very young. You'll see in a second. But I struggle with doubt. I doubt that God loves me. I doubt that salvation is for me. Plenty of times when I pray and I wonder, is anybody out there? Because I feel helpless. I don't feel like there's anything happening that's right sometimes. I suffer. I feel lost. I feel lonely. The doubt is not intellectual. The doubt is personal. And sure, I want some intellectual satisfaction, but deep down, I want to be personally loved and cared for. Why do we give up on any hero? Because eventually it feels like personally they didn't care, they didn't show up. Maybe it was someone who was supposed to be there for you, and intellectually you knew that they could have been there, but they weren't. We start to have these personal doubts when life got crazy, when you're hurting, when you're lost, when you experience loss, when you're lonely, when you feel poor, when you feel powerless, all these sorts of things. And the doubt goes from intellectual to personal, and it hurts a little bit more. And you feel small. You feel like you'd like to help the world, but you can't even help yourself. Do you know what this is like? I feel like I know what this is like. My goodness, I felt more helpless and smaller in this great world over the last 3 months than I think I have in my entire life. They told you we have a little daughter named Lainey. This is her. She's just so cute. That's her and her older brother, Denver, second to the right. He loves her so much, she doesn't know what he is. But one day, she'll know that he's her best friend. She was born 3 months and 1 day ago. And while in some ways I've realized, oh, wow, I'm capable of a kind of love I didn't know existed, I'm also capable of certain kinds of fears that I didn't know existed. Like, oh, my goodness. Like, at the hospital, I know that some people are like, wow, my spouse was there for me. They were so great. It might come to surprise you that that's not me. I'm not queasy. I don't pass out. I don't necessarily get scared at medical things like that. But, oh, my goodness, I was scared. I was so scared that at some point, Abby has like 6 or 7 nurses and doctors kind of like, you know, working on her and doing all these different things. And she looks at me and she goes, are you okay? I couldn't speak. I just go. One of the nurses who attends our church here, her name's Stephanie, she came up to me in the delivery room and she goes, is there anything I can do for you right now? I'm like, this is so humiliating. I'm not giving birth here. I was so at a loss for words. I was so scared. I was so out of my mind that as it's actually happening and Abby's like, wow, this is pretty intense. I'm like, hey, don't worry. You're the best at this I've ever seen. Like, duh, right? Like, I've never seen it before. Now I'll never unsee it. You know, it's just like, ah, it's scary. And you feel small and you feel helpless and you feel powerless. And like, my goodness, I want to help Lainey through every part of her life. I love her. Abby and I, we love her a ton. She's the best news that Abby and I have ever gotten. But I look at her and I'm like, what good news do I have to offer you in a world that goes dark? In a world where there is deep and personal pain. Like, what about her? What about her experience with loss for the first time? What about her experience with pain for the first time? What if I'm not there? What if Abby's not there? I don't just need a hero. She needs a hero, and it's not me. Deep down, we have this same feeling that the creator of Superman had. I can hardly help myself. How can I help you? So we get down into this deep feeling of personal doubt, and it actually hurts more than intellectual doubt. And I would say in many ways, it's harder to get over than intellectual doubt. It's when you experience profound loss. It's when you're depressed and you cannot see the way out of it. It's when anxiety shows up every single day before you put your feet on the ground. It's when you're going through a divorce and you never thought it was going to happen to you. It's when that person you always promised they would show up isn't there anymore and you feel small and you feel lost and you feel poor and you feel powerless. What now? Intellectually fine, satisfy my curiosity, but to be saved, I'd have to be satisfied personally. I'd have to be loved personally. And it reminds me of one more doubter in the gospel accounts. His name's Thomas. Have you heard of him? He's notorious for this. He's called Doubting Thomas. Thomas, he's one of the disciples of Jesus, but he wasn't there when Jesus appeared to his disciples for the first time after he rose from the dead. One of the 12 disciples, Thomas, was not with the others when Jesus came. Now the other disciples are telling him, hey, we've seen the Lord, but he replied, I won't believe it unless I can see the nail wounds in his hands, put my fingers into them and place my hand into the wound in his side. Do you see how much we can relate to Thomas? Like Thomas knew the teachings of Jesus. He had followed Jesus. He heard about the miracles. He saw the miracles. Everything that Jesus said he would do happened. But Thomas hadn't seen the risen Jesus. But he's hearing from guys like Matthew and John, hey, it really happened. You know me, Thomas. We've been around each other. We've been friends for 3 years, Thomas. The same people who are telling Thomas, it really happened. I saw him. He's risen from the dead, are the same people who are writing to you through God's word today. People like Matthew and John. And it seems like Thomas's doubts are merely intellectual at first, doesn't it? They're scientific. I have to physically see that he's risen from the dead. I'd have to physically touch him, put my finger in the wounds in his hands, put my finger in the wound in his side. I'd have to see that. I'd have to touch that. It seems intellectual, but do you see how personal it is too? I think it's more personal than it is intellectual, because Thomas was a young Jewish man living in a Jewish oppressed Roman Empire, but now he had started to follow this young leader who had all sorts of promises, all sorts of ways, all sorts of miracles, and it looked like Thomas's life was finally heading in the right direction. He had it made. He made promises and he fulfilled promises. Everything that he had said up to this point came true. But then, a week and a few days later, Thomas is sitting at dinner with Jesus, and he's starting to talk about dying again. And then Jesus goes out to pray in a garden. One of Thomas's close friends betrays Jesus. Another one of them is about to deny Jesus three different times. And it doesn't say that Thomas is with him, but certainly if he's not watching from a far distance, he's hearing about these things. Jesus goes into a garden to pray. All of a sudden, he's arrested. He's being tortured, he's being beaten, he's on trial. He's hanging on a cross. Whether Thomas is watching from a very far distance, because we know he wasn't at the scene of Jesus' death. It was too much, it was too hard. I wonder if he thought about Jesus' words with him. In John chapter 14, where Jesus said, "Don't worry, I would never leave you alone. I would never abandon you. I will come for you. I will be back for you. I promise you this." Thomas is looking at him and be like, "They're sticking spikes in your hands. They're nailing you to a cross. You're not getting off of that. And now my life is over. Jesus, the wounds in your hands, the spikes that look like they're ending your life are ruining mine." It's personal. For every intent and purpose, this is ruining Thomas's life. And once again, he's just a poor young man in an empire that oppresses his people. He has no future. How could he make a difference? How could he help anybody else? He can't help himself in this situation. So he goes around and he's got his own conditions. If he's really risen from the dead, I am not getting my hopes up again. Personally, it hurt too much to lose him the first time. He feels forgotten. Poor, powerless, lost, afraid, lonely, unworthy, all those things. He's a pretty relatable guy. God's people have felt like this and wrestled with these feelings for a long time. This isn't new. God knows what to do with these things. Many years before Thomas, God's people, Israel, they feel forgotten. They don't feel very loved, and so they cry out to God, "The Lord has forgotten us. What's going on here? Personally, this hurts. You're the God who parted the Red Sea for us. You're the God who led us into a promised land. You're the God who's spoken through prophets, but right now it feels like you've forgotten us. You feel left behind." God says back, he doesn't rebuke them for doubting him. He just talks back to his children. It's never forget you, never. Could a mother forget her nursing child? No. A mother's love is profound, isn't it? I've been seeing this for the last 3 months and a day. My goodness, Lainey controls our house because of the love for her. Lainey will wake up in the middle of the night crying and wanting food. If I had a roommate in college or seminary or at any point in my life, and they came up and woke me up in the middle of the night and said, "I want milk," I'd say, "Go get it yourself." But Lainey, she wakes up and, "We're out of the bed. I'll change your diaper. Abby will feed you. Here we go." And it's just, it's amazing. The unconditional love that I've seen a mom have for her child in this new seat, it's remarkable. It's more than physical. It's more than emotional. I mean, it is unconditional. And I see it in my wife. Like, every fiber of her being is driven into loving this child. You don't even know how it happens, it just does. And God says, even if a nursing mother could forget her child, I wouldn't forget you. What a claim is that? God, see, think about the most remarkable kind of unconditional love a human can have. That doesn't even compare to my love for you. But it's just talk, isn't it? It's just more talk. And love isn't talk, love is action. Love needs to do something. And so God changes the metaphor. Let's go ahead, take a look. I've written your name on my hands. I can't forget you. I look at myself and I think of you. You're always on my mind. I'll never forget the pain that you experience, it says right after this. You're always on my mind. And it sounds like it's just more talk, but it's not just a metaphor. Because the word for written there, the way that we would say it today in English, would be engraved. And how did they engrave things? With a hammer. And with a spike. Now go ahead and imagine someone willingly take a spike in their hand for the sake of someone they love unconditionally. At a deep and personal level. It's a horrifying, tragic, terrible image. And it's exactly what happened. Because many years later, there's our friend Doubting Thomas again. And he's going around. He's asking Jesus to satisfy his intellectual needs, but he knows deep down, personally, he's hurt. And he needs to know he hasn't been forgotten. So he goes around and he's telling his friends, I need to see his hands, I need to see his side, I need to touch them. And then I'll believe, only then. And then one day, 8 days after the resurrection, Thomas finds himself in a locked room. And there appears the risen Jesus, standing in front of him in the flesh. And what did he say? He said, look at my hands. I could never forget you. The blood poured out of me is like ink tattooing your name all over my body. I look at myself and I think of you. I could never forget you. Jesus has done what Thomas has been asking for, and you gotta ask, how did Jesus know? The text doesn't tell us that Jesus appeared to the disciples, and then he hung out with him every single time Thomas wasn't around. They talked about Thomas, and so the disciples reported to Jesus, hey, Thomas is saying this. It says Jesus appeared to them, and then 8 days later, here he is with Thomas. How did he know that Thomas had been going around asking? I gotta see his hands, I gotta see his side, when can this happen or I won't believe? How did he know? Because Thomas couldn't see him, but Jesus could see Thomas. Thomas didn't even know where to begin how to pursue Jesus, but Jesus would pursue Thomas. Sometimes in the Christian faith, we get it backwards, like, I'm gonna pursue Christ, I'm gonna pursue God, and there's nothing wrong with that, we should. But make no mistake about it, we experience faith, we experience transformation, we experience life, we experience unconditional love because he pursues us. You don't have to go to the ends of the earth, you don't have to climb mountains, you don't have to go into the valleys to know his love. He finds you, he's watching you, he's hearing you, he's listening to you. And no, I can't always see him, especially in the intellectual ways that sometimes I want to. I tell myself it'd be so much easier if I could just see Jesus and I'd hug him. But what does Thomas do? He's got Jesus in the flesh standing in front of him, willing to satisfy his intellectual desires, his curiosity. But Thomas doesn't touch him. All Thomas does is he falls to the floor and he says, my Lord and my God. And this is the first time in the entire gospel account, according to John, that anybody's looked Jesus in the face and said, you're God. And you haven't forgotten me. You see me, even when I don't see you. And he just says, my God, it's really you. Why didn't he touch him? I don't know. The only thing that my brain can really go to on that is Jesus' wounds became something more than physical evidence that he had really risen from the dead. It became personal evidence that Jesus loved him and did it for him. Jesus's wounds, sure, evidence that he's risen from the dead, and there's plenty of it. But more importantly, his wounds is this personal evidence that he did it for you. I mean, he came back to life for you. Because he loves you personally, deeply. And in these moments of my life, when I experience powerlessness, feeling poor, unwilling to do the right things anymore because I've just lost hope, I can know that Jesus, with all the evidence surrounding him, is capable of satisfying my intellectual curiosity. But how much more satisfied will I be if I see that he would satisfy my heart by loving me personally? And look what it did to Thomas. Thomas, the guy who wouldn't even talk about the risen Jesus. For the next 40 years, he spent his life telling everybody, shouting it from the mountains to the masses, he's God! He's really God! He actually is God. It's true. Believe it or not, I've seen him. He's really God, all the way up until he got killed for it. My goodness, if these early disciples could have a transformation like that, what could it do for us? It's one thing to be intellectually satisfied, but to be personally satisfied, it'll change your life. Look at his hands. Don't just see that he's physically risen, although he has. See that personally he loves you. He did it for you. And we might say, my Lord and my God. Amen.